Welcome back to Museum Some Chill, a podcast with the International Council of Museums where we talk everything and anything museums. This is Ana Paula from ICOM, and in today's episode, we continue our series inspired by the World Building, Art and Technology in a Climate Change World event, which took place at the Serpentine Gallery, an ICOM institutional member. Following our thought-provoking conversation with climate justice strategist Susan Daligual, we now speak with multimedia artist, creator, and world builder Alfredo Salazar Caro. Alfredo's groundbreaking work bridges virtual reality, sculpture, and digital media. Delving into themes of cultural identity, memory, and innovation, his perspective resonates closely with the sub-themes of the upcoming ICOM 27 General Conference in Dubai, Intangible Heritage, Youth Power, and New Technologies. The ICOM General Conference is a landmark event for museum professionals globally, offering a platform to explore how we can safeguard and celebrate intangible cultural heritage in meaningful ways, amplifying the voices of younger generations as agents of change, and harness emerging technologies to create deeper, more impactful connections with audiences. Alfredo's work provides a fascinating lens through which to examine these challenges and opportunities. In this conversation, we reflect on how museums can embrace cutting-edge technologies to preserve intangible heritage, engage younger generations, and create transformative experiences. Join us as we explore the future of art, technology, and cultural institutions. And without further ado, here's our conversation with Alfredo Salazar Caro. Thank you for joining us and for being here. How did you start using digital tools in your work, and what drew you to virtual reality or immersive experiences?
I started using digital tools sort of by accident, actually. Yeah. I was studying in art school, and I was a sculptor, and I took a class called Prehistories of New Media, and I didn't know what new media meant. I thought it meant like new mediums, new materials, and it turned out to be a computer art class. Just like exploring the history of this, you know, and at first I really didn't get it at all, but then very quickly I realized that the computer was one of the most powerful tools that an artist could use in the 21st century. So that's kind of how it arrived to my vernacular.
And then your work often uses digital tools, as you're mentioning. As co-creator and creative director of DMODA, the Digital Museum of Digital Art, how would you say museums can use virtual or augmented reality, and how do you see this in relation to the repatriation and sometimes rematriation of cultural artifacts?
So with DMODA, what we were trying to achieve from the beginning was actually more of like an institutional critique, right? So it was more so about taking what I found to be the most compelling artworks that I was seeing around my peers, and just, you know, back then it was like the early 2010s when I was exploring these ideas. And, you know, these artworks, these like digital artworks, like live performances and things like this, I wasn't seeing represented in the museum world. So we decided to create our own as a way to create a window for that. And then when virtual reality came out, it just made the perfect pairing, you know, where instead of just looking at these digital artworks on screens or on projections, we could actually be fully immersed in them. So DMODA really became a place dedicated to that, to exploring, you know, what is the potential of virtual reality as an art medium, and to invite other artists to explore it to its maximum extent. And then DMODA would just house these artworks. So that's really the goal of DMODA. But on this kind of idea of like rematriation of artifacts, that's something that I do more in my personal practice, not so much in the DMODA, but you know, I love the idea of being able to walk into a place like the British Museum that is full of stolen artifacts, and with my phone or with a camera, 3D scan these things that have been placed behind glass that, you know, usually belong in like ceremonial sites or, you know, indigenous people's homes all across the world, and bringing them back into kind of like the public domain, or giving them like a new form of ritual through digital spaces. So I play with those two things quite in different spaces, actually.
Decolonization, which is then in a very relevant topic in the museum sector at the moment. How do you see digital art tools and ritual storytelling help museums basically to address these?
I do think that there are moments in which these technologies can be super helpful, especially from an educational perspective,
yes.
Right? So I think one of the most prevalent examples that I can think of that directly affects me and is connected to me and my culture is El Penacho de Moctezuma. I'm not sure how you say that in English, but you know, Moctezuma's headpiece that is in Mexico City, there is a replica of it, and the original one is in Austria because it was stolen, of course. There were discussions of this artifact being brought back to Mexico, but then they decided not to do it because it was too fragile to actually move, and they were concerned that if they were to send it back to Mexico, it could be destroyed in the process, which is actually quite a fair point, right? This is a 500-year-old feathered headpiece.
Yeah.
So in that kind of situation, I think that's where, you know, these kinds of technologies can really come in handy, right? So instead of sending it back and allowing people to have it or whatever, like maybe one of the best solutions would be to do a super high resolution 3D scan and then allow people to explore it in that way, you know? So then you don't have to worry about the risk of damage. You can still give it back to the people in a sense, you know, it's still quite symbolic, but at least it's kind of like a step forward.
I actually have like an interesting story in this sense, because there was this totem that was in the National Museum of Scotland. And when the people, the just people that were actually the family that this totem was from, asked for them to give it back, they said the same statement, same argument. But then Amy Parron, which is the doctor that requested the rematriation of the totem, realized that they had moved it within, like, I don't know, 5-year span. So in that sense, she said, okay, but you've moved it before. So we've realized it actually does not affect the object itself.
Right.
So they just started this long-year process of rematriating the totem, but it took them a whole lot of discussions, more so because indigenous peoples have agreements that are non-written. And that made it so hard for the peoples to really translate to at least the Museum of Scotland to be like, well, our agreements are stone even if they're not written. Even if in another context it changes the value, for us it does not change. And so it was super, I guess for us it's also just questioning every single time something is brought up, that maybe yes, technologies are great as tools, but then we also need to question arguments at times.
I think that a lot of times these institutions that come from colonizing practices, oftentimes their excuses is that the people whose objects they have stolen from are not able to take care of them themselves. And of course, this is a complete patronizing way of looking at it. Nonetheless, I think that it's important to continue the discussion, you know, and to pressure these institutions to give back what doesn't belong to them or to compensate, you know, for that. So, you know, whether it means that, you know, indigenous peoples have free access to these museums or that those countries are, in fact, paying for the things that they took in some way or another, right? Maybe through cultural exchange, maybe through support of the local institutions, etc. But there has to be some kind of even exchange for the pain to kind of dissipate in some way.
I remember for this specific case with the totem pole, it happened that when they arrived with specific clothing because it was a ritual that was going to happen to awake the pole for them to be able to bring it back. And they had also these maybe fruits or vegetables, and the museum was like, hold up, we cannot actually have fruits in the museum. And they were like, well, you're literally holding an object that requires this element for it to be and bring the significance of what it is.
A lot of times these are, you know, quite living objects, right? Like a lot of, especially when it comes to like indigenous objects, like a lot of African art, like these are like fully functional objects. They're not from some, you know, ruins of a past culture, but these are living, currently being used objects that are placed in these institutions as though these civilizations have ceased to exist, you know? So it's quite a interesting battle.
Continue with the technology conversation. How can virtual reality can be harnessed to allow people from various backgrounds to connect with climate and heritage stories, even if they're not in traditional museum spaces?
I think one of the best things about virtual reality, it's just its ability to fully immerse a viewer, you know? So with that being said, what it allows for us to do is to take people into very immersive experiences that can leave them with like a better learning experience, or like instead of them just looking at a screen and watching a documentary, is they actually have a lived experience, right? Like neurologically speaking, psychologically speaking, to your brain, it actually doesn't, like your brain does not understand the difference between a virtual experience and a real experience. So I think that it can be a really great way for people to get a more profound sense of empathy towards an issue right? So specifically things like climate change, right? If we can, instead of just tell people statistics or even show them images, we can actually have them be, you know, in the Arctic watching, you know, the glaciers melt, or we can have them be in the middle of the ocean seeing the accumulation of plastics, or we can see, put them in the Amazon as it's burning. I mean, these are all very drastic examples, but sometimes like people witnessing, like it allows them to fully grasp the issue and then change their position or take action, versus, you know, if you just tell them like, okay, you know, 100,000 acres of the Amazon forest has burned. Okay, like what does that mean? You know, can a human even comprehend what 100,000 acres looks like? But if you put them there and you show them, that's different, right? So it allows people to see things that normally they would have a hard time quite grasping. So I think that's the power of virtual reality within that realm.
Yeah. What's one thing you hope to see museums do in the next few years with new technologies in virtual reality?
I think that one thing I would love to see museums do in the near future with these technologies is just implement them for deeper ways of education, right? I love the idea. I think as a child, you know, you're always attracted to these museums that allow you to touch everything. And then you go to these larger institutions as an adult and, you know, the temptation is still there, even though now there's like social norms that don't allow it. So these technologies allow us to actually, you know, kind of have a more tactile interaction, so to speak, right? So through 3D scanning of these objects and then giving those to the public, whether as digital objects or 3D printed models, so that there's kind of like a deeper exploration of these things. I think that would be really great to see it integrated in the next few years. And I know there's some institutions that have already started like to digitize their collections, but I would love to see them more forward facing into the public.
And then just to note to one of the projects that you, or that I've at least read you were working on doing this 3D printing housing, do you see that also in relation to museums and their spaces? Because as we've seen, or at least what I've been learning lately, is how museums either can be very they just transition. There's this museum actually in Colombia, Museum Q, Museo Q, which basically is not a physical place, it just transits around the country.
Cool.
And they come and they share the queer history of Colombia, and they just move around. And then I was just talking about this museum called Mumo, that it's literally a bus, and it's a huge truck that has a lot of art pieces, and they just move them around. In first it was in France, but then it just actually went to different countries in Africa, like Côte d'Ivoire, and it's just been interesting to see how museums actually move around. But how do you see this specific element of 3D printing translating to the museum?
You mean like in terms of architecture?
Actually, yes, architecture.
Sure. I mean, my exploration with large-scale 3D printing is very much connected to the concept of biocompatibility.
Yeah.
So I would love to see, you know, museums really... museums just because that's what we're talking about, but really, you know, society at large and architectural structures at large really consider how to retrofit their buildings to become more biocompatible, you know, and this can be done through many different ways, but I would love to see the museums of the future be built in more responsible ways, right? I think as an artist and as a creator, as an appreciator of history, I understand the function of these institutions, you know, to retain history, to showcase artworks, etc. But, you know, like every type of building that we have in contemporary society, they're quite polluting. And they're usually made with quite toxic material. So it would be interesting to see when we'll get our first Earth 3D printed museum of the future.
That is super interesting.
Hopefully not in the too far distant future we'll see something like this.
And then a last question in regards of museums of the future. If museums are to become laboratories for future imaginings, what values and practices need to shift within this sector for it to make it a reality?
Of course. I mean, I think that first of all is the decolonization of the museum space, right? Because as we were discussing, a lot of times that's where the practice comes from, right? It's from like a colonizer practice of, you know, archiving the remains of the cultures that they have conquered over or oppressed. So I think that just from that beginning point, you know, what does it look like to have museums that are truly decolonized, you know, and still be able to like share multicultural experiences? And, you know, I think that the beauty of it is, for example, back to the British Museum, right? Like you can go to this place that, although it's full with stolen artifacts, you can experience the culture of many places in the world that many people in Britain will never actually physically go to. So there is a power in that cultural exchange for sure. That is for good. But, you know, how can we be more responsible in the way that we share these cultures without making them seem like they are gone, or, you know, that they are less than, or et cetera, you know? So I think just culturally decolonizing these institutions would be the first step.
Yeah, definitely. There was this conversation that I was this conference that I was at, we were talking about the repatriation of objects in France.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember this question from a journalist where they were saying, yes, but if you ask for all the objects to be repatriated, what about the people that are looking at it? These objects will not be anymore known by this amount of humans. And I remember the person that was being interviewed was, yes, but like we need to also question the value of the people that are looking at it,
mm-hmm.
the value of the eyes that are appreciating it, because most or many times these objects are, as we were mentioning, part of rituals.
Yeah.
And then people don't know that, and people don't understand necessarily how these objects are in that those interactions. So for me, that was super interesting, because at the beginning, I think everyone can question that when you move it to its country of origin, then people are not, as you were mentioning, necessarily travel to these places.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also to question, why do we want people to look at it, and how do we want people to look at them?
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a super interesting take.
Mm-hmm.
The day, basically.
Yeah, I mean, the cultural exchange, like I said, I think is really valuable.
Yeah.
You know, but there, I think that there's much more sensible ways of doing it, right? Like invite the artisans from Côte d'Ivoire to build a piece for the museum in France, you know, that represents what it is, and that it can actually be fully ritualized and then brought into the museum with that spirit, as opposed to stolen from their land, you know. I think that would make like such a much more impactful way of bringing that culture forward without having to have it be done in such an oppressive way.
Yeah, I completely agree. Well, that's it for us. Thank
Amazing.
You.
All right.
Thank you for tuning in into this episode of Museums and Chill, where we explore the intersections of art, technology, and cultural identity with Alfredo Salazar Caro. His work highlights how innovation and creativity can help museums and cultural institutions address some of the most pressing challenges of our time, from preserving intangible heritage to engaging future generations in meaningful ways. If this episode sparked your curiosity, we encourage you to visit ICOM.museum to learn more about ICOM's mission and how we're working to empower museums globally. Thank you for listening to Museums and Chill.